Good morning. Welcome to Ag and Forestry. On a Thursday, we have several bills on the agenda here this morning. This is going to be the last time this committee meets, so it's do or die today. We have, as you remember, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 670, and we're going to have Al Elkins and Lindsey Ball. This was Senator Farrell's bill. As you remember, we had the Dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, having reviewed them all, the only thing we need here is the Dash 3 amendment. Folks asked about that before, so if you want to sort of throw that paper on the floor, we'll pick it up after the meeting. Also, we do have Mary Ann Mulligan, I believe, here from Legislative Council to talk about the criminal trespass issue.
Dash 3 is what we were looking at?
Dash 3 is what we need. That includes conflict amendment and all of the substance. It is a replacement for the printed bill. It includes all of the substance plus conflict amendment.
As you remember, this bill dealt with trespass issues and also originally had issues in their revocation of boat licenses or tags or whatever they call those things that go on boats. Mm-hmm. We took all that out and then amended it back, amended in just the issues with...
Mr. Chair, we didn't adopt the amendment.
No, we didn't, but this is really what we're looking at as far as the bill. This is the work coming out of your work group.
Mm-hmm.
And deals with horn hunting and wild crafting, and you would only then lose your ability to hunt and fish if it was involved, committed while you were doing those sort of things. But I wanted to have some testimony from the hunting group and from Lindsey Ball from the Department of Police, Fish and Wildlife on this. There seemed to be still some concern about this amendment. So let's start out, and maybe Senator Farrell, they can come later and rescue his bill if we really get to the problem here.
Okay.
Or try to rescue.
You want me to go find him again?
No, I think we'll get him. But I think there is still some real concerns about these amendments, and I want to hear about that here this morning. So.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Al Elkins. I'm representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I am speaking from and to the Dash 2 amendments. I don't have the Dash 3 in front of me.
What is the difference? The Dash 3 just has the conflicts, but otherwise the same as the Dash 2.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Elkins, the Dash 2 has in Section 2 an intent statement that really did not come out quite like what we were looking for, so the intent statement is pulled from it. It would not have a conflict amendment, which I'm happy to explain later. It's a very subtle thing.
Okay.
The only difference between the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 is that intent statement, and we're going to leave that out.
Okay. Representative Hill.
I don't believe I have the Dash 2s, and that's why so we're not going to talk about the Dash 2s?
No.
Okay.
I have the ones and the threes.
The threes are what
we're not to talk about the dash.
We're not to talk about
the dash twos had an intent, just a general policy statement in them.
We won't talk about it.
We're not going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. I sent out the amendments that I had to some of my members, and their focus is on questions in relation to the process and how the system works. And so I'd just like to share those with the committee. At the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that takes the tag or license away, if the court says that the license or tag should be taken away, and then the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife issues that by mistake, who's broken the law? Has the hunter or fisherman broken the law? And then in that case, is the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife liable for doing that if they have broken the law? And will the hunter or the fisher person be further punished? These were the kinds of things that I got from the people that I sent this out to. And what's the fine or violation for that? And I have not, I got these questions last night. I have not had a chance to talk to Captain Ball about that. So I was just wanted to.
The issue here is, as I understand it, we're going to revoke hunting and fishing licenses for 2 years, so then how do we keep track of that within the system?
Right.
And then if there's a revocation while they currently have it, then it's going to fall upon Lindsay and his crew to go out and take that away from someone.
Well, we don't know that.
Is that an issue here?
Yeah, that was my question. If I come to you at a point of sale, Mr. Chairman, and you issue me a license by mistake, and I go out and do what I do, hunt and fish, and you find out you've made a mistake, then how do I give the license back? Do you send me a letter, or what's the process? And then am I in violation, or is the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife in violation?
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would think in terms of that a person would know that they are not eligible to receive a license. And so I think that argument would fail in court if they came back and said, I went to Fred Meyers and I bought
right.
a fishing license. They would have known that they fell under the terms of this because it would have been imposed by the court on them. And so I think that would be a hollow argument in my mind in terms of that. So I don't think in terms of, as I'm thinking about this issue, not to hold anybody accountable for selling the license, it's just the person's wasting their money, and if they get caught, they're going to be in much bigger because they're not eligible to hold the license, assuming we adopt this and they have been found guilty of the trespass and they have, in the dash threes, the way it's written, and they fail to comply with the terms of the court, then the court could order the revocation of the licenses and the prohibition of them having one.
Harrison?
Mr. Chair, members, you may recall that at our last meeting we had testimony from ODF&W, I believe Rich Berry. He indicated that at this point they keep a list, about 45 names as I recall, and so they do not put their point of sale operators in the position of denying people licenses. But when a license is issued, they then have, I believe, state police contact people who receive those licenses. They did also testify that this would increase the number of people who might be subject to that revocation, so they would have to reconsider that policy and consider programming their computers to reject at the point of sale.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Barr,
to kind of follow on the Harrison statement there, I mean, that's exactly right what they said, but at that time they also said we were looking at a bill that did not tie the issues to horn hunting and wildcrafting, so where it would have been a huge at that time, I think now it is sufficiently narrow that they would not have to reprogram their computers, and they could use the same system they have today where, just as Harrison said, the agents will issue the license, and if a person isn't allowed to have one, then they would ask the state police or an agent in the Fish and Wildlife Department to go and get the license back and cite the person.
Does everyone, Harrison, have a copy of the statutes as it relates to these statutes that we're talking about? I have this handout here this morning that talks about the offenses. Everyone should have that also. Representative Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think also as I read in terms of, I'm on page 6 of the Dash 3 amendments, where it's talking about it, it does not place a prohibition of the person going out and getting the license. It just talks about revoking the license if they have. I don't see any language, unless somebody can point it out to me.
There's other languages. Oh, it shows for 2 years.
Okay, 2 years. Okay, so there is the prohibition.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, down in line 28.
Section 3. I see it. Okay.
Page 6.
So then we cover this. We cover the revocation and we cover the prohibition of it. And if they then
talking about this more on the mechanics is how this is going to work. So I think that's where the hunting group were concerned of the mechanics and this sort of thing. And Lindsay Ball was concerned about he had to go out and take those licenses away from people.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Also on page 6, on my copy, I have the and circled on line 6 with an or written out.
We've decided
that is probably incorrect.
No, we've decided to leave and in there because that's a higher level. They're not only convicted, they have to also have failed to comply with the requirements.
Right, and I was just going to say, the way it was originally written, makes sense. I was going to argue that.
We were debating this issue before. That's the reason it got written in.
Okay, so we should disregard the, on page six.
Yeah, and we'll stay.
Line six, page six, the and is there.
Yeah, it will stay there.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair?
I want to hear from Lindsay and Rod just a minute before we have a motion here to see if we're all comfortable. I'd like to have a testimony from you, Lindsay, on an issue of going out and the process of taking a hunting or fishing license away from someone who currently has one.
Chair Wells, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division for the Oregon State Police. As far as process is concerned, when a person currently is suspended by a court from the privilege of hunting and angling in Oregon, a notice is sent to the Department of Fish and Wildlife that his privileges to hunt and fish in Oregon, or singularly hunt, you know, separated from angling, it has been suspended for a determined number of months or years, depending on what the court decides. The court can decide that the person could be suspended for a year or 24 months in the current law, or even 6 months, as a court's discretion. Now, what occurs at that time is the Department of Fish and Wildlife holds a list of people who are currently suspended from hunting or angling in the state of Oregon. Now, that list is not put into the computer, per se, to prohibit someone from applying for a license or tag in Oregon while they're suspended. In other words, if you are suspended, can you go to a point of sale, a vendor that sells hunting and angling licenses, you can buy another license. Now, the reason that that was put in to policy from the Department of Fish and Wildlife is that the vendors are volunteers. They're descriptively providing the services to the public by selling licenses and tags, although they do get a fee for that. They did not want to put the vendor in a situation where they would have an antagonistic customer across the counter saying, well, I'm not suspended. You know, give me my license. And they felt that that would probably create or discourage vendors from participating in selling of licenses and tags. Now that is just the opposite of what is done with Department of Motor Vehicles that I think many people are familiar with. When a person has his driving privileges suspended in Oregon, that is put out on the computer, and that person is not allowed to get a driver's license at a Department of Motor Vehicles office anywhere in the state. So consequently, if the person does apply for a license, then that is through the point of sale program, that is tracked back at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now it flags those people who have gone out and purchased a license and tag after their suspension order has been delivered. Now that information is then provided to my department on a quarterly basis here at Salem, and we distribute that information back out to the field, and we instruct our people to go to the person's home or where we can find him and seize the license from him and issue citations to him for false application, because it's unlawful for him to apply for a license when he is suspended. Now, as far as an issue that the state knowingly allowed him to buy a license, you can see that could create some conflict here. So where the system is not built around prohibiting him from buying a license at a point of sale, such as it would be at a DMV office in comparison.
How comfortable are you people with this bill? Rod?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, Oregon Sportsman's Defense Fund. I'm not very comfortable with it at all. I don't like removing the judge's discretion. We're saying that the judge must do these things. Currently, the judge has the opportunity to review the case and make a determination at that level. I'm working from the dash one. perhaps that has been taken out of the, with the dash three.
The dash three.
The judge's discretion.
Mr. Chair, members, and Mr. Harder, the dash one has all of the substance. There's very slight differences between them all. The dash one is exactly like the dash three, except that it does not have conflict amendments for Senate Bill 20. So dash one is okay for session, and we'll try to get you a copy of it.
President Hill.
Maybe somebody can correct me here. On page six, looking at lines 4 through 13, and it's reading that, well, the person convicted of these specific things.
We're going to have Marianne Mulligan from Legislative Council come up and address that section.
I'm referring to the fact that the way it's written here, when the person is and they do the criminal trespass while they're angling, hunting, trapping, wild trapping, or horn hunting, and then it says, and the person fails to comply with the requirements of a citation in connection with any such offense, then the court shall. So to me, the way that sentence is written, that the judge would have discretion to say, if you go and do these things and you comply with what I told you to do, I don't have to do it. It's only if they fail to comply with the judge's order does the judge is then compelled to revoke a license tag, the permit.
Representative, is that a correct statement? We're going to be back to this, taking this and we may move them both back to or. Mary Ann, would you like
to... Can I ask Rod a question?
Yes,
thank you. Okay, Mr. Chair. Rod, where do you think it changes it from discretionary to mandatory? I'm reading through, and actually those sections are existing law. So if you could point it out specifically to me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on the dash one amendments, I'm reading on, and Representative Warbaugh, on page 3, line 28, 27, and 28.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have some other parts of the bill I'm uncomfortable with also. The definition of wildcrafting, it seems to me, and this may be a very minute point, but we talk about plant material, gathering plant material, whether it's for food, fiber, or whatever. It would appear to me that would be picking berries or blueberries or blackberries or mushrooms or what have you, and I think I heard Representative Thompson talk about his part of the country where defining property lines was nearly impossible. And so I would have a concern there, not necessarily from my hunter's point of view, but just from a general, just from a citizen's point of view. And those concerns expressed by Captain Ball are basically the things that give us the most concern, that someone would walk up to a terminal the night before the season were to open, like we did, we have those lines that go out into the street, and then there would be a problem such as this, and there could be a real mess generated. And I think it's not being fair to our folks with this wording where they could purchase the license while they were in violation.
Too much problems here. Mr. Chair, Mr. Harder and Captain Ball have just expressed the same concerns I had in our work group, taking the discretionary language and making it that the court shall revoke license. I felt it should be discretionary. Senator Farioli was very insistent that he wanted a mandatory, so that we did not agree on that issue. As far as I'm concerned, if it was discretionary, I think it would be, I could support the bill then enthusiastically. Was it mandatory, I'm a little more hesitant to do so, but I could still support the bill because I think it's pretty narrowed when you tie it to either wild trapping or horn hunting. It's not a wide open net. It's more of a focused shrimp net instead of a everything net.
Mr. Chair,
been here so long, I'm starting to talk my language.
I guess maybe I'm just reading it differently in terms of, but the way I read it, and I'm looking at the dash threes. It's only if they fail to comply with the court is then the court compelled to revoke. Is do you still want, if they, in, under their failure to comply with the court, do you still want it then discretionary at that point? I'm just, I mean, six of one doesn't the other to me, but I'm just...
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I think that some of my major problems is you and I are disagreeing on this particular thing. I don't know what it says. And I think you believe it says what it does, and I don't know what it says.
Mr. Chairman, just one other point of clarification. On the dash, I'm on the dash one still. Section 5 and Section 6 of the dash one talk about forfeiting the firearm, any bow, arrow gun, air gun, or firearm. And the question that one of the guys asked me last night, was this applied to the whole bill or just Sections 5 and 6? And I told him I would ask that to the committee today. I do not know.
I believe in the dash threes, we don't have that kind of language.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Ubelau has just pointed out one place. In current law, it is permissive if the person commits a violation while angling, hunting, or trapping of these issues, then it's permissive the court may take the license and revoke for 2 years. But if it is not permissive if the offense is committed while hunting or the taking of game mammals, that's the difference in current law. Then it's not permissive. The court shall revoke the license in that case. So I think if we're going to be consistent and we are going to do this, we have to make sure that we're consistent with current language, that it is permissive in the sense that if it's not done while taking a game mammal, it's permissive. But, we don't want to change current law and make it permissive if he's in the process of taking a game mammal. And I don't know, I can't answer this does, I think this does that, but I think we need the legislative council to make sure of that.
All I know, committees, we're running out of time on this bill.
Mr. Chair.
We have spent more time on this bill. Representative Krupp.
I would encourage the members of this panel to recall that the intent of this legislation is to punish those who maliciously and criminally trespass. That's the intent of this legislation, not to punish people who inadvertently do something out of a property, because they don't know where a property line is, or maybe they're picking berries. That isn't the purpose of this bill. The purpose of this bill is to punish people who are convicted of criminal trespass with maliciousness. That's what we're talking about here, and I don't see why it is such a problem for us to revoke their license if they've already been convicted of a crime.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, for the purpose of continuing the discussion, I would move the dash three amendments into the bill, and then we can let things live or die in its merits.
We have a motion. We're in work session. We have a motion to move dash threes. I think before we do that, I'd like to have Mary Ann come up and talk about this and or, because we may want to, from legislative council, we may not want that and in there, as I understand. Welcome to our committees. You can see we've had quite a time with this piece of legislation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grant Hagen from Legislative Council.
And Mike.
And I am glad that this issue has come up, because I had a long discussion with Virginia Bank.
I'm going to pull that mic over.
Okay. Is this better?
Yes.
I had a long discussion with Virginia Vanderbilt of our office about this, who has far more experience in these matters than I do. And we are both have agreed that the conviction, forfeiture of bail, are mutually exclusive, is that you can either be convicted or you can forfeit bail, but not both. And I, much to my embarrassment, and I drafted this, that and crept in there inadvertently, because you can't have, you can either be convicted or you can forfeit bail.
I think you're right. We debated this, Harrison and I, for quite a while also.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hill.
However, in line 7 of the dash 3 amendments, we are deleting the words forfeit bail or otherwise, and so the sentence is referring to the person failing to comply with requirements of a citation in connection with any such offense when the base fine amount of the offense is 50 or more. So we are getting rid of the issue of them forfeiting bail, and it is referring to the bail amount and their failure to comply with the court.
I think that is because of the conflict with Senate Bill 20, which gets rid of the forfeiture bail. It sets base fines, and if that's the one you're referring to, you said...
That's on page 6?
Page 6.
What is it, Marion?
Pardon me?
That is correct. Yes.
And that's to, we have a conflicts team and legislative council. There's Senate Bill 20 that's sitting out there. So if Senate Bill 20 should pass, which gets rid of these with the forfeiture, and it sets base fines. And so this, what you're looking at on page 6, the base fine amount, is it consistent then with Senate Bill 20? If Senate Bill 20 shouldn't pass, I mean, that's the conflict between the two.
So we have some conflict amendments.
They're part of the dash 3.
It's part of the dash. They're now are part of the 3.
Mr. Chair, just so I can understand this. So can you walk me through, am I looking on page 6? Am I looking at the conflict amendments then?
Yes.
Okay.
It starts on page 5, section 1B, which says if Senate Bill 20 becomes law, and then it goes on from there. We've got section 1B, 1C, and then section 2, which on line page 5, line 20, the and should not be there.
Okay. Can you tell me where the same section is that I'm looking at on page 6?
Okay.
Where's the same section that we that would otherwise be adopted in the absence of section 20?
Okay. It
was, so I'm understand the two.
Okay. It would be on okay, I think it would be on page 1. Let's make sure.
Page 5, section 2 is the substance of our bill.
Page 3 is the conflict.
Right, I'm sorry.
One
yes, that's correct. Yeah. Line 22.
Line 22.
And then where would it be in, let's see, this is somewhat confusing here now.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe Section 2 is our operative language. That's what we're doing in this bill, and Section 2A is how we would conform what we're doing to the changes in Senate Bill 20.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
That's correct, yeah.
I guess the question comes then, do people have a problem with the conflict amendment language, and why don't we just adopt the conflict amendment language if that's clear, versus because then it takes out the issue of bail and it's talking about the court orders the revocation if they fail to comply with the court, the court has an opportunity to tell a person this is what you got to do, and if you don't do it, what you're risking is the loss of your license. And if they fail to do that, then the licenses are revoked. I mean, is that a better, just get rid of the other language?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Barr.
I would like to withdraw my motion and let you close the work session, let this thing just quietly go away. I think it was more confusing than it was worth right now.
We close the work session on Senate Bill 670. Thank you, Marion, for coming down.
Now where we want to go.
Thank you.
It may be a good idea if there is next session.
Maybe we should
over the more people talk, the more confusing it gets.
Always is.
We've got the Juniper people.
Oh, I got blanks.
Yeah.
What's the number? One of these.
There we go. Hearing on Senate Bill 1151. We have some people here. Excuse me. Take that back. I want to go to SJM 14. We'll open a hearing on SJM 14 dealing with Eastern Gilbert Blight. And So whoever would like to talk about your memorial, please come up. What's this memorial do, Harrison? Understand while we're getting our paperwork here.
Senate Joint Memorial 14 urges the Oregon Congressional Delegation to ask the United States Environmental Protection Agency to allow growers to use a particular chemical to control eastern filbert blight. That chemical is propiconazole, and I won't go any farther in trying to explain EPA's process. I will leave that to our experts here.
Welcome. It's nice to have you here today. I'd like to introduce yourself. I show a Sean and a Jay and a Richard. I'm not going to try to pronounce your last name.
Chairman Wells.
Record, say your name on the tape. It's nice to have you here today.
Chairman Wells and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Richard Birkemeyer. I go by Rich. I'm from Canby. I'm a hazelnut grower in Clackamas County, and currently serving my third term on the Oregon Hazelnut Commission. And with me this morning is on my left, Dr. Jay Scheidt, plant pathologist from OSU, and on my right, Dr. Sean Mellenbacher, a plant breeder working with hazelnuts from OSU. I'm going to keep my comments fairly brief and kind of let your questions determine which direction we go here. And
that'd probably be the best if you've handed out written testimony. We can read that basically because we're kind of short on time. Just tell us what the problem is and why we need to do this, and tell us who's opposing your issue.
Sure. We've been dealing with filbert blight since 1986 in Oregon. It was previously in Washington, but in the years since 86, we've been spending a lot of money and energy researching the plant pathology of the nature of the fungus disease and what we need to do to effectively control it. About 2 years ago, we formed and we've been very successful with that. About 2 years ago, we formed a committee to determine a strategy for our future from what we know now. That is a two-part strategy. There's a short-term strategy, which includes detailed pruning of the blight, along with chemical control measures. The purpose of that is to slow the spread of the disease down long enough that growers can last until there is a new immune variety released from the college that we can plant and get established. We're looking at probably 10 or 15 years to make that conversion. Our ultimate solution to eastern filbert blight, we now recognize, is an immune variety. It just takes years to make the conversion. Our immediate need is the most effective chemical control for eastern filbert blight. And with that, I'll leave it to your questions.
Is the chemical spray available on the market now?
Yeah, the chemical propiconazole is available in a number of trade via a number of trade names. Tilt is one trade name. Orbit is the trade name that we'd be using in tree fruits. Alamo is used in for injecting shade trees, and there's another name somewhere. Break. So it's used on a number of crops throughout Oregon already.
So what is the problem? You need a registration for.
We are trying to seek a registration for Orbit. Yes.
Mr. Chair,
has there been work on getting that registration by the company?
Yes, the company supports that. In fact, they've petitioned EPA for a nut crop grouping back in 1989, and there's been very little, if any, movement on that since.
Representative Byer and Representative Rubel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is an important issue, and we got a lot of other things to do. If you want to go to work session, I would be happy to make a motion to send this bill to the floor.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I
have one other person I want to hear from.
I have a question.
I have a question, too.
Representative Rubeloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this chemical you're seeking approval for is cancer-causing or considered to be cancer-causing, and it's already used on some crops, and I understand that's true in Oregon, too. Is that correct? Is there not some threshold that, you know, we could be going over that threshold in the use of this particular chemical here in Oregon, and would this take us over that, or is there a possibility?
That's basically the current controversy with how EPA calculates these the risk environment. The U.S. Congress had the Food Quality and Protection Act issued to EPA. The FQPA might be the acronym you've heard. Basically, it directs them as to how to assess risk. Right now, EPA has been using basically the analogy is the risk cup. Basically, how big is that risk cup? EPA would like to use a small risk cup. Proponents would like to use a little larger risk cup. Each of those are considered to be below safety thresholds for the U.S. Food supply.
Who made the determination that this is cancer-causing or possible?
I'm not aware of that.
Yes. Now, I know, I understand that OSU is working on a blight-free tree. What's the estimated date of when you might this might occur?
Chairman Wells and Representative Urbelow, I'm Sean Mehlenbacher, the hazelnut breeder at OSU, and we've been working on eastern filbert blight immunity since the mid-70s. I haven't been there that long. And we've made tremendous progress. The target date for release of the first immune variety is December 2004. We already have advanced selections in yield trials, and they're planted in grower orchards around the Willamette Valley. So we're pretty much on track.
Okay, one final question is, since that's about 5 years from now, is there not something that could be used, some alternative to this cancer, at least possibly cancer-causing agents, that could be used in the interim for the 5 years?
Jay Scheid again. There are alternative chemistries that we can use. The alternative chemistries are looking at the same sort of problems. One of those is Bravo. Chlorothalonil is the name of that. That's our currently labeled for eastern filbert blight. It's we are seeking the Orbit chemistry because it's more effective. We actually use less of the active ingredient than we would be with the alternatives, so it'd be less going out in the environment, and it's also cheaper.
Representative Thompson.
Actually, my question is that. Thank you.
I guess I get a little concerned when I see language risen that is considered cancer-causing, yet we don't know who made that determination. Like every time we hear about chemicals around this country, especially this legislature, and say they're causing cancer, I'm going to rebut that a little bit.
You know, I've just got a serious question, Mr. Chair. Okay. I just want to know why you people call it hazelnut. I grew up there called filbert. So I have filbert growers and orchards out in my area. I don't have hazelnut. I don't know what that is.
So do I, Representative Hill. It's a real struggle to call them hazelnuts.
Yeah, I almost made a mistake there.
One question to you.
I'm going to go to a work session.
Okay, I understand. But is this a... I'm not familiar with this chemical. Is it something that can get into the streams and water systems... Or is this something that's water soluble?
This particular chemistry, the use rates that we have it to be applied to the trees, it is systemic. It moves into the plant tissues. Any chemistry that wouldn't move into the plant tissues would fall to the would be washed off by rain to the ground. It's not soluble and it's quickly broken down by microorganisms in the soil.
I close the hearing on the Senate Joint Memorial 14 and open the work session. Representative Barr.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Memorial 14 before the BPAS recommendation.
I have a motion to move the floor. Any other discussion? Samantha, I call the roll, please.
Chair Lyle?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
No.
Representative Urquhart?
No.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative
Hill? Aye.
Representative Decker?
No.
Representative
Hoffman?
No. Representative
Cook?
Oops, he's not here.
We'll stand by just a minute.
It's really shouldn't be, you know, they shouldn't be opposing vote.
Mr. Chair, can I, the option explaining my vote, no vote on this, it's not because I'm not sympathetic for the cause, but I'm just worried that at this late date in the process, that I haven't had the opportunity to sit down and research the chemical and the consequences of using the chemical. It's not that I, if I had a little more time, I think I could get there.
And I would echo that, Mr. Chair. I mean, we have this statement that says cancer-causing. I don't know what the risk is, high risk, low risk, whatever. We're already using it in the state, and I, before I can vote for it, I don't have enough information.
I think the issue is we're not making that determination. We're urging EPA to move ahead.
I know. I realize that.
Before I do, I would like to know what I'm urging them to do, and if I had a chemist sitting in front of me and he told me it was fine and it had no consequences to streams or anything, and I believe what you're saying, but it's just a matter of reluctance at this bill being this late in this process coming forward.
Mr. Chair, the person testified that the formulation is Tilt. Tilt is a fungicide that is used by hundreds of thousands of acres of grass seed already in the industry in the Wyoming Valley. All spring long.
Representative Hobson.
I agree with all my colleagues, but in the interest of moving. Oh. I was going to say I would change my vote because we have other issues we need to talk about.
Yep. We're voting on Senate joint tomorrow, 14. We need your vote, Representative Krupp.
Krupp votes aye.
Hill votes aye.
Hill votes aye. Hill changes aye. Vote aye. Would you aye for?
Aye.
We have five votes.
You're an aye?
Yes, ma'am. That's correct.
Senate joint tomorrow, having received the majority of votes in the committee, is moved to the floor. They do pass.
I'd be happy to carry it.
Representative Byer, carry.
Mr. Chair,
you want to carry it?
Sure, I'll carry it.
Is that Representative Cronin?
Sure.
Mr. Chair. In interest of the parties, could I say, if you could get me the information so I felt more comfortable before the floor, I'd be more than happy to change my vote on the floor.
Well, that was a work session. Thank you for coming.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Four sessions, 10 o'clock. Four sessions?
Yeah.
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 And
the
photos. We had some photos around here,
and at some point, they're right
down here.
So that I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1212. We had testimony last time on this issue. We spent an hour on it. We have the amendments to 1212, plus we have some A5 amendments that need to be put into the pasteurized issue if this bill moves ahead. Are you guys with us here?
We're on 12-12, Mr. Chair.
Are you in public hearing or work session?
I haven't opened either one yet. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 12-12, and we're going to hear from, we had two other people that did not testify the other day, and they're the people from the Oregon Dairy Farmer Association, Don Moisson and Jim Kahn.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, did you want to take care of the dash flies first?
Let's just hold off just a minute here. Don and Jim. Where we are on this issue, we're going to have an up and down, up or down vote on the amendments dealing with the compact. If those amendments pass, then we'll move the bill. If it passes, then the bill will move to Ways and Means. If that up or down fails, then we still have the bill dealing with the pasteurized milk, and we'll move that. Then we'll have a vote on that to go back to the floor. So if the compact issue is voted into the bill, then it will be a vote to move it to Ways and Means. So you can think about that, and we're going to have a short testimony here just for a minute from Oregon Dairy Farmers.
Chairman Wells, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Cron. I'm the program manager for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. My job is to work with producers in farm management issues and many other things, but that's one of the areas where I work in. What I'd like to do for a minute here, I've handed out a packet of documents, and we'll discuss those in a minute. I'd like to give you just a short 101 milk pricing seminar here. It'll only take a minute, but milk pricing is one of the most complicated things. There are four or five people in this country who are considered experts on milk pricing, and quite frankly, some days they are not even sure they're experts. But let's talk about it just a little bit. Number one, many of you have discussed and talked about free market. You want to base your decision that we should be in a free market system. The dairy producers of the state of Oregon would 100% back being in a free market system. We're not. Haven't been for over 50 years, will not be allowed to be in a free market system. In the recent 96 Farm Bill debate, the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association supported one of the amendments in that bill that would get us closer to the free market system. International Dairy Foods Association, which is the organization who represents United Grocers, Safeway, Albertsons, was in favor of the portion of that bill that did not allow for a greater free market system. If the Oregon Dairy Farmers had a free market system, we wouldn't be here today. We're not allowed to have that. So under that scenario, we are forced to look at ways in which we can gather a larger percent of the consumer dollar. Okay? Within this pricing system, it's important to remember as I discuss things here in a minute,
sure,
that there are four...
Representative Coleman, yes. What, can I ask a question?
Yes.
What prevents you from being able to be in a free market system?
Well, because of the federal regulatory system that we have to live under. Okay? All right? Within milk pricing, there are four classes of milk. It's really important to understand this as we move forward. There's class one, which is what you drink. Class two is ice cream and soft products. Class three is cheese. Class 3A is powder. 30% of the milk that Don Moisen produces on his farm is fluid milk. Okay? So as we talk about a compact price of $15, that represents 30% of his milk, not 100%. Okay? All right. Now what I'd like to do is spend just a few minutes, and I have given to you my written testimony on the back part of this document, and I will reference a portion of that in a minute. I really feel it's necessary that I discuss with you the validity of some of the statements and charts and graphs that were handed out to us and to you folks on Tuesday. First of all, Mr. Head from Safeway Corporation discussed and said in his testimony, and was very vehement about this, that Safeway had supported and does support the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation. I have supplied to you on page one a letter that was sent to all Safeway producers on April 2nd of 1998, i.e. just in the beginning of the formation of the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation. Let's read a portion of paragraph one, second line. The purpose of this letter is to inform you that Safeway intends to maintain its contractual relationship directly with its producers, and does not recognize NMMF, Northwest Milk Marketing Federation, as a representative of producers or as having any contractual relationship with Safeway. Mr. Head stated Safeway did support and has supported the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation. Number two, page two. It was stated that that Oregon is not a milk deficit state. You see a map with some dialogue below that. This map shows the per capita production that exists within the state of Oregon. As you see, in Oregon, we produce 482 pounds of milk equivalent per person. If you look at the dialogue in the far right-hand corner, it says dairy product consumption per capita in 1998 was 588 pounds. That's how much, as a consumer, you consume in a milk equivalent basis. We are a milk deficit state. This information is provided by USDA. Okay, let's go to page, the third page. This is a document that was provided to you by the gentleman from United Grocers. It says...
I'm not with you. What document are you working on?
Yeah, we're looking...
Looking at this handout here?
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
A Safeway on the front of it?
Yes, it'd be the second page now, Chairman Wells.
You're on the third page.
Now I'm on the third. Okay?
Okay.
This is document number 3 that was handed out by the gentleman from United Grocers. It says, who loses if Oregon joins a dairy compact? Let's move to assumption number 1. Assumption number 1 says, and we'll skip the first line, go to the second, the estimate is based on a minimum compact overorder price equal to current Northeast compact overorder for beverage milk, parenthesis, $16.94 per 100 pounds, or $1.46 per gallon. The dairy compact bill that you have has stated and always stated that we are at $15 per hundredweight. Never been $16.94, always been $15. Also important to remember back to milk pricing 101, we're talking about 30% of the milk, not 100 pounds, but 30% of that 100 pounds. Let's go to assumption number 2. Assume the maximum compact price allowed by law in 1999 or $22.28 per hundredweight or $1.92 per gallon. The bill that you have before you has said $15. It's always said $15, not $22.28 per hundredweight. The commission has the ability to ratchet this bill up only with the consumer index price. And that commission is made up of a cross-section of citizens of this state, one dairy producer. Now, let's pop back up to the numbers that exist. Minimum annual cost of compact in Oregon. United Grocers have said that is $18.8 million. Maximum cost, $55.1 million. You have heard testimony stated that we have had the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation in place. That is a process that has had a $15 Class 1 minimum, i.e. same as a compact. I spoke yesterday with the general manager of the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation. In 1998, that federation was in place. It paid to producers in the state of Oregon $1,236,000. $1,236,000. Not 18.8, not 55.1. I will let you to determine the validity of chart number 3. Let's go to number 4. Let's take a look on the left-hand column. It starts on top and says school lunch and breakfast programs. And this is entitled the potential cost of the Oregon Dairy Compact to low-income families. We have submitted an amendment to the bill that holds school lunch and breakfast programs neutral. Everybody's aware of that. Women and infant children program have been held neutral in the bill from the very beginning, has been in it from the start. I don't understand why they're in this portion of this document. Then let's go to the top part. And it says annual cost of milk tax of 24 cents a gallon. We can pop back again to the previous chart. That 24 cents a gallon is based on 1694 a hundredweight. Never been 1694, won't be 1694. Second, maximum cost. It says annual cost of tax at 70 cents per gallon. That gets you to $22.28 per hundredweight. We've always been at 15. That's what we've stated in the bill. That's what the bill says.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I know that we have amendments to the school lunch, school breakfast, and WIC. Some of the other programs I have some concerns about, and can you tell me if your amendments take care of those at all? And I'm talking about the food stamp, the nutrition program for the elderly, those programs. Do your amendments hold them harmless?
Okay, Chairman Wells, Representative Rubel, no, at this point they don't, but it's very important to understand that the Compact Commission has the right to do those types of things if they wish. We as an organization have recommended that the Compact Commission consist of one producer, one processor slash retailer, one consumer /representative of low-income food programs, representative Department of Agriculture, and an agriculture economist. This is a wide variety of people. We want them at the table. We want them represented, and we want this dealt with fairly.
Mr. Chair?
You
know, and I certainly appreciate that, but my sitting here voting on a bill, I don't know what the commission will do, although I'm sure they're good-hearted people. And I guess my question, well, I don't guess, but my question is, why not hold these people harmless also in the amendments now? And then I would have a much higher comfort level.
Chairman Wells, Representative Ruhl, the reason we're at this situation is we have been recommended that if we put too many things in this bill, there really won't be a need for a commission. And the commission needs to look at each of these things individually and can make those decisions on their own. We added the school lunch and breakfast program in. And again, we have no problem. These people need to be accounted for. But it's also important to realize that in the last 8 years, the price to consumers has gone up 46%. The processors and the retailers have not shown any desire to hold these programs harmless up until this point in time. So the commission should have the right to take a look at these things. And we as producers are very willing to look at this. We would hope that the processors slash retailers would take the same look. Okay? Let's take a look at chart number 5, provided to us by United Grocers. As I said to you earlier, I spend about 50% of my time working with Oregon dairy producers individually. I have visited probably 90% of the dairies in the state. Representative Hill represents an area where there are a large number of small dairies, along with Representative Beyer. When I looked at this chart and it said between 1 and 49 cows, number of cows per farm, that 27% of the dairies in the state of Oregon represented this number, I knew it wasn't true. I contacted yesterday the Department of Agriculture CAFO program, Confined Animal Feeding Operations. This is the organization that deals with water quality for us. Every dairy in the state of Oregon must have a permit, number one. That permit is based on cow numbers. If you'll take a look at the next page, you will see I received yesterday in the mail, a fax from Alan Yost, who's a statistician from the Oregon Department of Agriculture CAFO program. 3% of the dairies in the state of Oregon are between 1 and 49 cows, not 27%. 3%, not 27%. In addition, when you look at what has been done here, we have gone down to saying the minimum average, the maximum average, from 1 to 49 cows, we say, it's been told to you that it's $3,400. Maximum is told to you that it's $9,800. Then we look at 200 cows or more. The minimum is $104,000. The maximum is $304,000. Last year, the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation, to both Oregon and Washington dairy producers, at a $15 Class 1 minimum, paid an average of $4,800 per dairy. Those dairies averaged 260 cows. 4,800, 260 cows. I'm not sure how we come up with 304,000 or 104,000. I will let you determine the validity of that chart. Then let's skip over to the graph. I love graphs. This graph was presented to you at the end of the testimony the other day. If you take a look at the graph on the left-hand side, let's look at the top. It says $3.30. Let's slide over to the right. It says $1.80. What this graph does is build in a guarantee, and on the left is what you pay as a consumer, or I pay. On the right is what the producer receives. What has happened here is there's been a built-in $1.50 guaranteed profit in this graph. Okay? I'm not arguing about the numbers at this point or the validity of those numbers. I'm just talking about the way the graph is structured. Pop over to the next page. You will see, and I'm a little old-fashioned, I have a hard time making my computer work, so I still believe in graph paper. This is that graph starting at 330 maximum, $1.50 minimum, all on the same axis. And you'll see the spread. Okay, let's pop over to the next page. One of the problems with this graph is that the numbers that are talked about here are based on a gallon of milk that comes off the farm from the dairyman compared to the retail price. That's not comparing apples to apples. What you buy as a consumer, you maybe buy 1% skim milk, 2%. What comes off of the average dairy farm in the state of Oregon is 3.79% fat. Tremendous amount of value in that remaining fat. So what we've done here, a gentleman by the name of Howard Becker, who works for the Oregon Milk Marketing Federation, has done a survey on retail prices, and you can see those retail prices, April of 92, 219, down to April of 99, 291. You can see the raw milk price adjusted to 2% milk. So this is what the dairyman gets out of that retail price, apples to apples. So out of the 219, the dairyman got $1.02. Out of the 291, a dairyman got 84 cents. Difference between raw milk and retail price. Remember, it's apples to apples again. And you can go down and see that. 91, the difference was $1.07. 92, the dollars difference was $1.17. 99, the dollar difference was 207. Percent of raw milk cost in retail price. So in other words, what percent of Don Moisen's milk does it cost for the gallon of milk that I purchased? 2% to 2%. 46% in 1992, 28.87% in 1999. You can see the bar graph of those same numbers on the next page. Now, on the final page, you can see the bar graph, exact same numbers. You can see the relevance to the bar graph from Howard Becker. You can see this bar graph. This information is provided by USDA from 1991 to 1998. When you look at the percentages, the farm retail price is the black part. That has increased 14% over the last 8 years, from 1991 to 1998. The retail price has increased 46% during that period of time, and the spread has increased 81%. I only ask one thing of you as members of this committee, and that's to base your decision on the truth. Thank you very much.
Representative Hill, we have about 20 minutes still. We're going to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious in terms of, I guess late as really as the 60s in terms of dairies. Had a truck, went out and sold products more direct in terms of to consumers. Now the market has changed, and where consumers now expect to purchase their milk in a grocery store. You're talking about the spread. How much do you think you should get there from the retail price versus what the dairyman should receive? I guess because if the spread there, I guess there's nothing that caps the upper retail price of that.
That's correct.
And so, you know, if the wholesale price is just going to go up, that tells me the retail price will go up. It won't be absorbed in terms of, because why would someone else absorb additional dollars flowing to the dairy?
That's correct. And the price to me has gone up 46% over the past, since 1991. The price to Don Moisen has gone up 14%. That's already occurring. You're already seeing a huge ratchet upward. And what you're seeing is, if you look on one of the last graphs I showed you, we went from a 46% share of the consumer dollar down to 28% of the consumer dollar.
Mr. Chair.
And the price has still gone up.
Representative Crummell had a question next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two things very quickly. One is I would just kind of defend Safeway or whoever, or USDA. Anyway, on chart number three, they had, if my memory serves me correctly, they had told us that the assumptions were erroneous because of the prices that were in there. Second thing is that a question for you, sir, is that if you already have the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation in place, why do you need to compact?
Very simple. Sure. Chairman Wells, Representative Crummell, very quickly, the difference between a federation and a compact is, first of all, the federation, the price is determined by a group of producers. That's number one. Compact would be determined by a representative's cross-section of people throughout the state. Number two, the difference between the compact and the federation is there is regulatory authority that's given to the state to ensure that all processors and play equally. In other words, what I'm saying is that if I'm a small processor, if I'm Alpen Rose Dairy, I do not have the ability to bring milk in from Idaho as a Safeway does. The Compact Commission would make everyone, processors and producers, play on an equal playing field. And in this situation, that isn't necessarily the case.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your the graph just before this one, your table, where you said it went from 46% to 28%, that's a true statement if we go to April of 99, but if we just would have happened to stop at December of 98, it would have been 47%. So what you have done is you've gone to the worst time the dairy has been in a long time, because if you look at the numbers through that, the rest of this time, if you didn't go to April of 99, you would notice that it has been relatively constant. It's gone from a high of 53, 54 to a low of 31, but the numbers are relatively constant in that time period. So you're accusing the grocers of giving us erroneous figures. I guess I'm telling you that you have done the same thing and chosen the statistic that best suits your information also.
Chairman Wells, Representative Beyer, those numbers prove exactly why this compact is necessary, because that 28% drop was not passed on to you or I as a consumer. I have presented to you every number that exists, and that's the exact reason why a compact is necessary, because that savings by the processor slash retailer was not passed on to consumers.
Mr. Chair.
I want to go on the vote here right now.
But I just give another final clarification on this?
One more word.
Okay, thank you. That is true. It is only May of 99. If you look at history, when the raw milk price has dropped to the producer, to the dairyman, the lag in the reduction is usually at least a month. If you look at your own charts here behind, so I would assume that if the 99 one is... the May of 99 number is on here, maybe this number again would be somewhere up in the 30s or 40s.
I think with that statement, I'm going to go and close the hearing, go into work session. I think anybody, as you realize, in being around this building, you can make numbers say whatever you want them to say, and you can usually assign them to make your case. I think we've heard a lot of argument on this issue. You've all been lobbied. And it comes down to us. We have to make a decision. So we have a work session on 12-12, and Representative Hobson, would you have a motion to move compact?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the Dash-3. I move that we adopt the Dash-3 amendment.
We have a motion to adopt the Dash-3, which is the compact into Senate Bill 12-12. You understand that a compact is, of course, a group of states who work together. In order to work together, they have to be ratified by Congress. So this bill has to be ratified by Congress for this to happen. So is there any other discussion on this motion, Representative Cromwell?
My only question is, how important is the pasteurization aspect of Senate Bill 1212?
If this motion would pass, Then we will amend the Dash-5s into that. They'll go together both then to Ways and Means is where the bill will go.
Mr. Chair,
if this motion fails, then we'll adopt the Dash-5s into the pasteurization issue, and that then what's left will go to the floor.
Mr. Chair, could I ask where the Dash-5s came from?
They came from because we have some problems here in the original drafting that takes out this language right here. On both sides.
Mr. Chair, did they come from you, or did they come from somebody in the group, or somebody in the audience?
They came out of our first hearing when we had a concern about that this was drafted incorrectly.
So they came from you, basically?
Yeah.
From the committee, yeah.
From the committee, yeah. Okay. So with that, what does Representative Krupp do?
Would you go without objection?
So, Nancy, I call the roll, please. On the motion to adopt the dash, well, the dash threes, or the dash threes.
Chair Wells?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
No.
Representative Erbelow?
Yes.
Representative Fire?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Krupp?
Aye.
Representative Hummel?
Aye.
Art, we voted. You want to vote?
I vote yes.
Dash three.
The dash threes are adopted. I receive a majority of the committee. Before we move the bill to Ways and Means, we need to adopt the dash five.
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to try to explain this again. I think I gave you the right answer the other day, but not necessarily the right reason. If you have your printed copy of the bill, the 1212A, if you look at page 2, section 5, if you look at subsection 2 that starts on line 7, what we have here is the first sale of milk by the producer. It says a licensee shall not sell milk or cream unless the milk has been pasteurized or was produced by a disease-free, in this case, goat herd now. But it's an or, it's pasteurized or a disease-free herd. If you drop down to 5, you'll see that the second sale now requires that it be produced by a disease-free herd and pasteurized. Well, if it was not a disease-free herd in the first sale, you can never go back and cure that defect. Or a defect, I use the word loosely. So what we're doing is, this is an existing law flaw that we're fixing here, where we had an either or, and then subsequently we had a requirement for both.
Okay, on line 13, we're dealing with the processor here. That's a product processed or manufactured. And in on 13, that's the processor. On line 7, that's the raw milk producer.
Yes, the raw milk producer must have pasteurized or been using a disease-free herd.
And then we're dealing with goats. We're dealing with goats here anyway.
We're distinguishing between goats and cows, basically, is what we're doing.
If I were to show you this section of existing law, you'd see that the goats are added by this bill. Existing law says no licensee shall sell, offer, or expose for sale any milk or cream which has not been pasteurized or produced by a disease-free herd.
Representative Hill.
Move the dash 5 amendment.
Thank you.
Any discussion on the motion? Is there anyone object? We've adopted. So now we need a motion to move Senate Bill 1212 as amended to Ways and Means.
So moved.
Matthew, let's call the roll, please.
Who made that motion?
Representative Hill.
Representative Hill.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Yes. Aye. Senate Bill 1212 has been moved to Ways and Means. I guess we have a recommendation. Is that the motion? Do we do pass or do we do that? We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1212, and we'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 1151.
Okay.
We have some wood chips here on our desk coming from Juniper and some cool pieces of wood here. That's as tall as those trees grow. And so we're going to hear, as I understand the issue, we're hearing from some people who have been working with trying to promote juniper as and harvested as a wood products, small wood products industry, and they're looking at some issues concerning the harvest. Oregon Forest harvest practices and some of those issues. So with that, nice to have you here. We have Larry Swan and Mark Kane.
And
good morning. We've run out of time on that building. We have no problem with that.
Really?
Go ahead.
You bet, please.
Senator Farioli was here trying to resurrect still his bill. That was the first one we dealt with. We spent a lot of time on that.
Chairman Wells, my name is Larry Swan. I'm a U.S. Forest Service employee who works in forest products and economic development in partnership with the Oregon Economic Development Department. I thought Senator Farioli was actually going to talk to this one we're just talking about right now because he carried it on the Senate floor last week, and it was passed without dissent. He's in from Eastern Oregon and can speak quite eloquently of the reasons why the industry is trying to do what it's doing. But I'm going to go through, I realize the time constraints are very tight. Pictures are worth 1,000 words, and rather than present tables and charts and graphs, I'm the technical background. I've been dealing with this since 1991. I was asked by the forest products industry to take a look at the species because they couldn't figure out why farmers and ranchers were being paid to pile and burn it when they were starving for fiber. We figured we could do better than that. Well, we've tried. We can do better, but it's a struggle. I have with me Mark King, Reach Incorporated. He's probably the largest user of Western Juniper fiber in this nascent industry, and he'll address specifically the bill because I cannot advocate for or against a bill, but I'll give you the background to it. Number one, the precipitating event for the legislation, Mark's firm started up the first dedicated commercial Western Juniper harvest operation near Klamath Falls last summer. Questions immediately rose concerning interpretation of forest practice rules, administration of Department of Forestry programs such as state fire liability laws, and also administration of other agency programs by the Department of Forestry such as DEQ regs regarding seeps when you're working in dry seeps or springs areas. And finally, whether forest harvest taxation should apply to a product which, even after 8 years, I can say candidly, has no value and is causing a decline in property values for the ranchers and farmers in Eastern Oregon. Okay, acres and trends. These are my quick pictures are worth 1,000 words rather than graphs, charts, and you do have written testimony here. There is 2.2 million acres of Western Juniper. That's not a lot by a lot of standards. It's a lot when you have it on your ground. That's what it represents, what it should have been. What you saw before were thousands of acres, and this is what we had prior to the late 1800s. Due to a multitude of events, we had an explosion density and area of Western Juniper in Eastern Oregon. We've had a 500% increase since the 1930s. And the vines of it are not large by industry standards, about one-tenth that of alder, but it's a lot, about three times that of Oregon Myrtlewood, which has a viable and very healthy industry. But what we're doing is we're losing at this point 1 million acres where we can't, where the trees are moving in, and we've lost the understory. That's 1 million acres, and we keep losing literally tens of thousands of acres per year, where the tree has outcompeted the understory, has left virtually bare ground. There is no natural insect pest or anything that's knocking this thing back. The trend is bad. The only thing we can do is either mechanically or manually manipulate. This is research from OSU, but it'll show a clear progression. If we do it right, we can obtain excellent results. If we do it wrong, we can really muck things up. In this case, we use the slash because it's the only key nutrients left on the site. These are arid sites. They get less than 12 inches of rain a year. If we have a seed bed, we don't have to seed beforehand, but we do get some response within 2 years, and after 5 years, we get at least 5 to 10 times the amount of forage. We get much more diversity, and we get a heck of a lot more diversity in our wildlife species. So we can do good, but it's not inexpensive. For a farmer or a rancher to go out and do this, on $25 an acre land, it costs them a minimum of $35 to treat it. So we have to find ways to defray costs. We also have something that's highly interesting in that in the right situations, at higher costs, we can get some surface water response. It's not scientifically proven. The anecdotal evidence from me as a land manager, though, is overwhelming that we can do this. And that's highly important, as you might suspect, in Eastern Oregon. Previous products, firewood fence posts. Going to have to push it.
rustic furniture. There were only a couple of people working on this in the early 90s. But now, due to the efforts of many people, they're actually making doors. This one person sold hundreds of doors.
General there.
Yeah. But there's been a heck of a lot of effort going on. We're all leaving it at that rather than pick up your time trying to get this done from work. The main thing is that the only product we've been able to find that will help defray cost of management, which runs literally hundreds of dollars to try to get this stuff cleared off, is shavings. And that's what you have in front of you. The solid wood is an excellent example of the value added. But we can that does not make a significant dent in the watershed restoration efforts. We have to find a fiber product. And I've personally been involved in over 50 different trials trying to find a fiber product that will work with juniper. Everything works, but not economically. The only one we've got is shavings for animal bedding. And Mr. Kane here can address that.
Welcome. Nice to have you here today.
I'm Mark Kane, the executive director at REACH Incorporated in Klamath Falls. Thank you, Chairman Wells, and fellow committee members for allowing me to speak. I came on very short notice, and I apologize for not providing some written testimony, but I'll give you some brief comments from the point of view of someone involved in the business of restoration. REACH, by the way, is primarily a rehabilitation agency whose business is to create and manage businesses that employ people with disabilities. So we create businesses to create jobs. During the last year, we spent nearly $1 million on this Western Juniper project. Much of that was state, federal, and private foundation grant support, given in large part in recognition for the restoration work that we do on site, as Larry was explaining. The process that we go about involves first either a landowner approaching us or our soliciting a landowner where we select a restoration site. We send a restoration planning team to the site. In exchange for the restoration plan, the landowner gives to us the stumpage for free. So there's no value to the landowner in the stumpage. In fact, as Larry pointed out, there may be some negative value. Many times farmers and ranchers have had to pay to have this material removed in the past. That raises one of the questions. Initially, when we set out our business plan, we received a letter ruling from the Department of Revenue indicating that the tax privilege tax would not apply. Subsequently, that was reversed, and we've had to pay the tax, or we begin the tax bill at least. that significantly affects the margin that we planned in this project for profitability. And it's that margin that we rely on to demonstrate the replicability of this project throughout Eastern Oregon. In other words, we're trying to figure out if there's enough margin on the shelf to do the capitalization without public or grant support down the road and create more jobs throughout Eastern Oregon. So one of the questions that comes up, by the way, is, are we dealing with timber? And that's the brunt of the bill, by the way.
I was going to ask that question, Mark. Should this be under Department of Forestry or under Department of Ag, this issue?
That is the real issue, Chairman Wells. Apparently, both departments feel they have jurisdiction, and some of the policies conflict, and it leaves folks in my position somewhat frustrated. Now, I'm not being critical of those departments. The Department of Forestry, for example, cooperated very nicely with us during this last year in our initial pilot site and was very supportive, very practical. But we're concerned about whether or not we can rely on that from every forester in the future and how consistent those rulings might be and whether we can base sound business plans on that kind of situation. As I pointed out in the revenue situation, the initial ruling was reversed, and that really affected us negatively down the road.
I have a question, if I can interrupt you for just a minute. In the summary, it says it includes Western Juniper in definition of a forest product and excludes it for definition of the timber tax. Now, do you have a copy of the bill in front of you?
I don't have one in front of me, no.
Okay. Well, I assume that the part that exempts it for timber tax is the definition of timber.
Yes. Right. That's the approach, yes.
Right. But you say that it includes unit for definition of forest product. Well, the way it's worded, it actually excludes it. So I'm wondering if you look up.
You're right.
Yeah. So I'm saying, what, you know, there's a conflict here between this summary and this, and what is it supposed to do?
Mr. Chair, members, commas are a tough drafting issue. if you're looking at page two, line two, forest product means.
Right.
And I would suggest that the two commas set off that parenthetical but do not interrupt the list.
Well, I would suggest otherwise.
Your reading was my first reading, and I had to read it several times to decide that it does, in fact, include, but you can read that comma either way.
So you want to include it?
No.
And I think
we do not want to recognize the timber products from
here,
actually.
It pretty well explained it. That's Western Juniper.
Well, okay, but I'm telling you, the summary says it does include it, so we need to make for the record what do you want, what's your intent, to include or exclude?
Oh, I think the problem's in the staff measure summary.
Well, let's ask what they want. It's their
bill. They want to exclude it.
Well, let me hear from them.
Chairman Wells, Representative Uwe Bilal, let me give you a somewhat lengthy answer in a minute. Typically, we look at timber as being fir, pine, cedar. Those species produce lumber, and they produce byproducts, waste, that becomes shaving.
I don't care about the definition of timber. I'm not trying to cut you off.
I'm
calling on the forest products definition.
Do
you want it to be included or excluded?
We want to be excluded.
Okay.
And the reason is that we're producing shavings as a primary product from a stem that would not generally be considered a saw log, but incidentally produces a small number of saw logs.
Representative Barr? We have forest session. I'd be happy to move this bill if we're in work session. I'd vote to do so.
I need to hear from Department of Forestry. There's a controversy about this bill.
Can I make two quick comments before I leave, Chairman Wells? Okay. One of the main points I wanted to leave with you, or two main points I wanted to leave with you, one is that if we're subjected to a tax and called timber product, then that provides a significant disincentive to do restoration work, and I can't get landowners to give me stumpage that they're going to get taxed on. Okay. The second point is some concerns about precedent. I think that the precedent issue is related to value. There is no value here. We're talking about negative value due to decreased forage, degraded watershed, reduction in biodiversity.
Yeah, we understand that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Greg. Let's have Charlie and David Wallen, if you want to come up. You were in my office and visited me. You had some concerns about this bill. Evidently, over in the Senate, they didn't address your concern because they moved it out. Can you tell us what the background is here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, Charlie Stone, Assistant State Forester, and very quickly, the bill as it was originally introduced dealt only with the Section 1 that asked for a study to examine how various laws affect their ability to economically harvest juniper. The two tax exemption provisions were added in. We had objected to those because we felt that they should be part of that study, as well as the Forest Practices Act and how it applies. There's been little or no actual discussion in front of Senate committee or elsewhere as to what the numbers and values are. And from our point of view, taxes are fundamentally an equity issue amongst the folks that pay them, and there's been no opportunity to discuss other situations where forest products harvest tax is paid, also in marginal operations in some cases, and various different species that are harvested. Those folks pay the forest products harvest tax, and so we felt that these two exemptions were premature before the study is conducted. We're very supportive of the study. We've committed to do that with or without the legislation.
Pete, you're kind of a neutral party here. Would you like to come up and tell us what do you think in this issue? Help us out. Because we have adversarial issues around this body.
Thank you, Chairman Wells, members of the committee. For the record, Pete Test, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. We testified on this bill. We see any product from juniper as secondary to control of juniper for watershed, water quality, and other purposes in Eastern Oregon. And I will take one step further and say that the values and the costs of $25 an acre land are pretty close, but the costs are closer to $45 to $100 to appropriately harvest that material. We are real concerned, and our policy in Farm Bureau has been all along to keep juniper totally away from the Department of Forestry for the reasons that we're visiting right here. We consider it, if nothing else, a noxious weed. Consequently, we agreed to this bill because we have to find out where state law is so we can either make an effort to change it or get policy such that we can do the appropriate thing with juniper. But one of the things we agreed to along with this bill was it would be really a good offer by the Division of Forestry to forget taxation for juniper, because immediately when they do that, we will go on an effort to make it considered a noxious weed statewide. Because if you're going to tax juniper and you're going to leave the option open, that does not tell me that we're dealing in good faith with the Department of Forestry. If they even want to consider taxing it, we have a problem with that. Now, we do know juniper belongs in certain areas in the state. It's a native plant. It was basically in those areas and confined to those areas by fire and wildfire, which man, for one reason or another, has detained. We are not interested in eradicating juniper. We are just interested to try to get the amount that we're taking off the ground, 2.2 million acres. I believe there's data out there that I could find you that it's expanding at 3 to 5% a year, and we are harvesting less than 1% on all activities. I'm not really concerned of us being able to eradicate this tree. So therefore, we agreed to this bill, and we were even more agreeable when we eliminated the tax. And we believe that tax exemption should remain. And maybe the Department of Forestry can handle juniper if they'll keep the tax exempt, but maybe they won't have any desire to in that agriculture, and we can try to do it ourselves.
Looks like, Charlie, you're getting kind of outgunned here a little on this issue.
Well, as I stated to you in your office, we weren't planning on breaking our pick on this one, but we felt from the standpoint of tax equity that this ought to be discussed further.
I think let's go to close the hearing. Let's go to a work session. I think we have the votes to move the bill, Charlie, like it is. And so with that, Representative Hill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1151A and gross before the due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, may I make a comment?
Yes, we have a comment on the motion, yes.
Actually, this bill may be a good bill, bad bill, a different bill. I don't know, but we are moving stuff that has an impact at the end with very little information, and I am comfortable with that, so I will vote no. It's really nothing against the merits. It's the process. I don't think we have enough information.
Mr. Chair?
President Krupp?
I like the bill. I want to move it forward. I think we should exempt this from it because someday we'll be growing forests of hemp.
Sounds great.
I think with that, we better vote.
Mr. Chair, before we vote, I have to clear up a potential conflict of interest. I am a landowner in Central Oregon that has many hundred acres of juniper on it, and that would probably affect me.
There was juniper and sagebrush over there. Samantha, you'd like to call the roll, please?
Farewell.
Yes.
No.
No.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Senate Bill 1151 is moved to the floor with a due pass. I'll carry the bill. The hearing is closed. That concludes our work for the year. We're going to have a party we're kind of working on that issue, so you'll be hearing from us. So with that, we thank you for the good work, and for that, we send
a dog that gets bedding too. I don't have a dog. I don't have a dog either. I have two dogs.